So welcome back. This morning we heard a bit of a lament. We tried to figure out ways in which we could engage business angels more often in commercialization. We heard about the trials and tribulations of mobilizing venture capital and the difficulties of doing so and the problems facing that. And we heard about the quality of entrepreneurs. And this afternoon's panel, we have some people who are going to be maybe exceptions to those statements or maybe inspirations. I believe inspirations, too. The focus today is internationalization for this panel. And it's an interesting group we've got. Barbara Orser, who is the Deloitte Professor of Growth Enterprises at University of Ottawa, will be moderating this panel. Barbara is known for the studies that she carried out and published, working with Industry Canada and partners at Industry Canada and other partners at Telfer that have set the stage and helped us identify how important SME financing is. And so Barbara's going to be leading this panel. Beside Barbara is Isabelle Bette. And as you walked in today, you perhaps saw those rows of bicycles that are for rent. Well, that's Isabelle's innovation, or a part of innovation, of her innovation. She is the president and CEO of 8D Technologies. The idea of those bicycle rentals won an award as one of the best 50, one of the top 50 innovations, not in Montreal or Quebec, but by Time Magazine in North America for the year 2008. A very successful entrepreneur who has a really good story to tell about internationalization. Beside Isabelle is Nancy Mathis, and I'm delighted to have Nancy. She's looked at this problem from a number of perspectives, both as an engineer who's developed a technological breakthrough that was successfully commercialized, and now as the founding CEO, Nancy, founding executive director of the Wallace McCain Institute in New Brunswick. And she's doing things right now to help other firms commercialize their innovations and their ideas and to build growth companies in New Brunswick. And she has a story to tell that I think the rest of Canada might do well to hear. Beside Nancy, Todd Evans, and I'm going to introduce him together with Jean-François Lamoureux. Both are from Export Development Canada. Before I set pen to paper to think about what this panel today might look like, Jean-François wrote me and said, we'd like to be there. We want to be part of this. We think we have some ideas that might help firms better commercialize their innovation, better internationalize, and we have some things we're thinking about that we'd like to get feedback about. So with this panel, I look forward to a really good discussion about the challenges of internationalization, the ways in which those challenges get overcome, and some of the ways that public policy and those who implement public policy might smooth the way for that. So with those words, I'll turn it over to Barbara.
Okay. Thanks, Alan. Okay, just to set up the panel a little bit further, because I'm an academic, I love factoids, and I think it's worthwhile for the international guests today to know that in Canada, less than 10% of Canadian small and medium enterprises actually export or go global in the life of their firms. So we indeed have distinguished industry leaders on our panel today, but we also have a challenge in terms of considering the wealth creation opportunities around internationalization. And just to set the stage for me, when I was on the train this morning, my seatmate was a self-employed consultant, expert metallurgist, it seems to be a theme at this conference, involved in lithium extraction from salt. And his biggest challenge was getting across the border to consult to American firms without being hassled for taking American jobs. And so this is a very simple example of a multitude of challenges and opportunities that are present in the Canadian marketplace. So what we thought we would do today is we would start with a little bit of background by each of the panelists telling their story, because it is a story that needs to be told. We have very, very little data. We have very little research on internationalization of small and medium enterprises. So when we talk about commercialization and internationalization, we have an awful lot to learn. So we're going to listen to their stories, and they will revolve around the challenges and opportunities. And then I have a couple of questions that I'm going to present as it relates to innovation policy, SME policy, trade policy, academic policy. You can see the challenges ahead. And then we'd like to throw it open to the floor to have more discussion. So we'd like to back up the presentation with more of a collective discussion around this. So, Isabel, I leave it to you.
Good afternoon. So I'm Isabel Bete with 8D Technologies. I thought I would tell you a bit of the story about 8D so you can understand where I come from when I come with some recommendations or suggestions, or at least it's the experience that we had at 8D here. We're based in Montreal on the Maisonneuve, very close to here. So 8D is a company I own with my partner and brother in life, Jean-Sébastien. So he is the high-tech guru, and I'm the business sales marketing person. So back to back, we really oversee 360 degree of the company together. So if we look at 8D today and 8D when it was created in 1996, it's a pretty different company in the sense that where we started and where we are today is not exactly what we could have envisioned back then. We started as a service company, so consulting, doing custom developments for our clients, training, and so on. And we turned the company around in 2000 to become a product company. So our vision, both of us, my brother and I, was to have this company where we could sell product around the world. So the vision was really to go international was something that we could do everywhere. In terms of the product, well, of course, we had a deep knowledge on the technical side, having developed so many applications for so many clients. So we had developed a platform, and I'm not going to go too technical here, but just to give you some context. So the software platform we had would allow us to develop applications faster and put more innovation in there, even though you would develop for 10 years. So we had done a project on the service side for a client where we could develop what he wanted in 6 months. As for competition, they could do it in 3 years. So big difference, no magic in there, just the way we developed that platform. So about 60% of the job was done, and then customization for each application would be like 30-40%. So we had that platform. We did a lot of R&D. Actually, when we turn a company around, when we talk about challenge facing organizations, we decided to do that in early 2000. So at that point, the opportunity for us was one of our biggest customers. They went bankrupt, and they owed us a truckload of money at that point. Not going too well, and a short time after that, we are high-tech, 8D Technologies, so the high-tech bubble burst. So that happened early on. So at that point, we were not in really good shape, as you can imagine. So that's where we decided to say, okay, I mean, that's what we want to do. We want to go product. Let's go. So we started investing in R&D, and we've done that for a number of years. So taking that platform, rewriting it to address a horizontal market, so fairly large market, and we wanted to sell that platform. So it was a software platform, as I said. So we started discussions with, remember, we wanted to go international, so with players like IBM, Sun, and so on. Very interesting discussions, and we saw that 10 years ahead, we'd still have very nice discussions and no contract. Because what we were trying to do was to sell a generic platform, and for those of you who have tried that, no can do. I mean, you rely on people's imagination to figure out what they can do with your product. It's not good. Nobody has that sort of time to invest, right? So at that point, and now we are maybe in 2002, we decided to do what we were selling to our client. So take our technology, software platform, and realize a project with it, something really real that people could understand. Because in high tech, oftentimes, I mean, you talk about what you do, people are like, yes, but they don't get it at all. So it's nice to have something that you can see and touch. So something real. And a partner of us came to us with a project that one of his clients had, which was to do a real-time wireless payment in a parking meter. So you know the parking meter station, the big ones, high tech. So I was a manufacturer from Sweden, parking meter manufacturer, and they couldn't do real time. So when you process your credit card, I'm sure a lot of you had the opportunity to try paying for a parking space in these machines. So when you try to pay and the credit card is expired, for instance, well, I mean, the operator will lose the money because it takes like 3-4 days to be processed when it's not real time. So the challenge was to have it real time. So we thought, great, I mean, we have the technology to do that, except for the hardware part, because parking meter are outdoor, and outdoor, the solutions are wireless. So there's no electricity, and the data is sent through wireless networks, which means no electricity. You need to be efficient in terms of power management. So we had the solar-based solution, but we needed the hardware to manage the power, so we needed to develop some hardware at that point, which we did. We had that expertise, so we integrated that in our solution. And for those of you who have seen the high-tech parking meters in Montreal, that's the solution that we have developed. Basically, we have 90% of the solution. What we don't have is what you see, the big box. What's in there, the brain, the hardware and software is ours, and the back end, the software to manage, you know, for the agents to do real-time monitoring of who paid and who didn't pay. The tickets are not our fault. We just do the technological solutions. So it's a pretty efficient system. So we were going for $500 in Montreal when we bid with our partner, because the one for which, you know, the manufacturer we developed that solution came to see us when Montreal went out for tender, because what they wanted worldwide, nobody could provide that to them unless they would do massive R&D. We had about 70% of the solution. So we partnered with that manufacturer, and we won. And it was for 500 pay stations, and today we have 1,700 pay stations, so solar-based, wireless, so that went very well. So I skip a few years. We started marketing that, and we went in Canada, U.S. as well. We wanted to go international, and our strategy was the Big Brother strategy, which means that we, with a direct sales force, you have a lot of challenges, let's say, for smaller organizations, such as being able to deal with a larger company. Larger company is one thing, but a large city with a small company is a real challenge. And to overcome that, the Big Brother strategy, meaning having a partner who has been there with the credibility and so on, will cut, you know, shortcut really the process. So that was the strategy, and we stuck with the manufacturers to do that. But when you choose a partner, it's really hard to make that relationship work. I mean, nine times out of ten, it will not work. But still, for us, it was a good strategy that we wanted to follow. That partnership was not the best one because our partner was also our competitor. At least that's how he saw himself. So that was a bit of a challenge, and we decided along the way to design our own box. So the parking meter you see for us, it was an interactive multimedia station, pay station. And you can do anything you can buy using a ticket or anything you want to park or rent off this pay station you could do. It's interactive, multimedia, and so on. The meter that you see, the pay station you see at the Big C stations, is ours. The looks of the original one is different. This one, Montreal wanted to have a special design to fit with the whole thing. So, but we didn't mind to have our meter disguised. I mean, it's for a good cause. So we developed the meter along with the rest of the solutions. And a few years later, Montreal came to us and just to talk about the bike. This bike solution that they were maybe thinking of doing. And basically at that point, we were ready to go because it was the same technology we had in parking, same horizontal platform. We needed to develop the specific parts for the bikes, but it was the same technology. So for us, our best ideas with an AD came from the client. And it's both. I mean, it comes from the client, but at the same time, you have to be ready when the idea comes. Because if we didn't have the platform, if we didn't have the meter, then the opportunity comes, but there's no way you can go after it. Because in Montreal, we had like 6 months to put a prototype together for the Bixi. A prototype, it's not like in a lab. It's out there with you on the bike, and you want it to work. Because when you bring it back, I mean, if you cannot duck it, if I'm going to charge you $2,000 on a credit card, it doesn't work. So it's no time. So the opportunity will be a good one if you're ready, but when the idea comes from a customer, well, it helps a lot because it means that you don't have to educate for 10 years, which is a real problem when you have a business because you cannot survive without contracts for 10 years. So that, the bike came along, and again, for marketing internationally, how do we do that? Because that was always the goal. So we started having discussions, and Montreal, when I say Montreal, it's organizations within Montreal public bike system, decided that they wanted to go after the other cities. And our strategy, still being the Big Brother strategy, was a very good one for us. And because we are after a municipal market, it's very a lot of politics in there. So oftentimes we see that a city will sell to another city. The mayor go to Shanghai with bikes, you know. People from the mayor's office will talk to their equivalent in other cities. And it helps a lot the process because Montreal will sell, but Montreal is the client also. They are using it. So it's in terms of strategy for us, it was great. And the reason it's working is because we don't overlap. I mean, it's clear, the technology is clearly within AD. The meters, the back end, the software, the brain of the solution in the bike ducts, when you duct the bike, the brain is there, not in the bike, but there, and in the meter. So it's our solution that is everywhere. So there is really no overlap. For them, it's about let's market the solution. And for us, it's about let's market the solution and provide a technology everywhere. So now, and it has been very, it's quite an incredible journey because from last spring to like 2 weeks from now, we have deployed Melbourne in Australia, Minneapolis in the U.S., Research in Motion, the campus, Washington State University in California, Montreal, of course, phase one and two and more, London, U.K., end of July, and in a few days, Washington, Arlington, Washington, D.C. So it's a lot. I mean, it's a lot of deployments. It's an opportunity for which we all needed to be ready. And for us, it's a great story because now when you are on the roll with all these cities on board, well, we're moving on to other vertical markets, parking, biking, and there is more to come. But the strategy for us is a very interesting one. For a small company, if you want a breakthrough, and I say that, you know, quickly, I mean, it's been 10 years since we went from service to product, but still, some of the hurdles that you have when you sell to go with partners will help a lot. And in terms of the policies associated to that, and we've been having some discussions with other groups, because how do you make it easier for all the parties together to make business together? If the big brother, the big company or the city or whatever potential partner for small company have an incentive to go with a smaller player, they have the knowledge and the technology and so on, an incentive to go local, wherever it is in Canada, that will help everybody. Because these guys, they have needs. So to have also discussions, forum of discussions with these guys, what are your needs? So that we are ready when the customers have a need. You know, when they express, I want to do something, it's not just about answering that need, it's about being ready to answer that need. So this conversation has to go on, you know, and that is a very, for me, that is a very key point. Another important aspect is financing. The strategy we went after, and actually it's not a strategy at all, it's more of a consequence. We bootstrapped the company, basically. We don't have any VC with an AD. Not because we didn't want to, didn't talk to them. We actually did talk to them, but money is one thing, smart money is another thing. So sometimes, because our culture here is not as deep as what we would have in other country where they've been at it for a long time, it's oftentimes a blind leading the blind. I'm pretty sure today that with VC in my company, we would not have been able to do the bike. Because I told you, we started here and now we're here. There is a link, there is a logic to us, but when you get financing and they finance you based on what they signed on, well, when it's so different down the line, it's a problem. So, and also when you raise money, the vision is tough for an entrepreneur when you try to share something that, you know, for us, we wanted to, you know, have products that we would sell around the world. So, yes, it was a bit more than that. We would explain, and we actually had a platform. Probably the fact that I was 8 months pregnant with twins when I tried to get some money didn't help my credibility. But nevertheless, there's this challenge here when we talk about solutions. For me, when we talk about mentoring is great. I mean, it's not because you have never done it as an entrepreneur that you cannot do it. And it's a great idea to get the know-how from outside to be able to do it because then you can create wealth. because you will have people who can do it, they have learned it, and they'll do it next time around, you know? And they can teach to other. And when you teach entrepreneurs, well, don't forget the whole ecosystem. And ecosystem is, yes, the entrepreneur, the team, but also the finance people. Because they need to understand when you come up with strategies and so on, they need to be on board. That is really important. We need all together to have that knowledge. And there's a lot of initiatives, one that I know because I'm involved with Fondation Entrepreneurship, for instance, where they have, you know, mentoring groups and worked with MIT on that. So wherever the knowledge is, let's grab it. Let's bring it here so that we get good at it, us too. So am I out of time?
Yep.
I'm good? In terms of other, let's say, recommendation challenges that we faced and low-level type of product that would help, when you build a company, and that's probably my background, sales and marketing. I've been in sales for quite some time before launching my business. And for me, the real thing is revenues. Financing is good, but financing is attached to get where you want to go. And don't get me wrong, you need it, but you need the revenues. So when you have a chance, and that's always the goal, keep close to your customers, sign the first one, get money from your customer when you have that order early on. It would be great to be able to get money for that, meaning being able to finance purchase order. And I'm not talking about factoring, because factoring is your clients will pay in a long period of time, so, you know, to get the money in the meantime, you can go with that product. What I'm talking about is really, I have a purchase order today. Can I get the money today for that? And very few companies will do that. I had one that supported us, you know, during these 10 years. Every time I would have a PO, I would go to him. But I talked to a lot of different organizations from the government as well, and it's not a product that it exists, but it would be very valuable. I know that in the panel this morning, at least one is doing that as well. And it's good that, and it's an entrepreneur, no wonder, you know. It's a real need for me to be able to get the money from early on. And financing, again, is good. But the money we got from different loans from Investissement Québec, from DEC, which is Economic... exactly, Industry Canada. We got from R&D tax credit, which is great. A lot of discussions right now because the understanding when you are marketing a product, the product is out there, well, you're done. You're not done. You know, in high tech, if you're done there, you're really done because you need to run ahead and make sure that the guy who just saw that, hey, I mean, they've done something great, let's go at it, and we have tons of money, tons of people. I mean, we're 40 people. We need to run ahead. So when the product is out there, let's make sure that the R&D just... you know, remains somewhere in there. And also, let's not forget that it costs more money to market a product than to develop it. And oftentimes, when you get to the point where we're ready to go on the market, there's no money to market it. And I have heard that time and time again from my colleagues. There's no money to do it. And at AD, I'm more of the sales person with that experience, but oftentimes you have the engineer, you know, being the CEO or the entrepreneur. So they don't have that know-how, and it makes it even more difficult. You think that because, my God, it's so good what we've done. You know, the phone will start ringing. Not really, you know. So you need money to be able to market.
Okay, I think we'll stop there, and we'll keep it going, and we'll come right back.
I wanted to put a timer, and I forgot to put it on. See?
Okay, sorry. Merci, Isabelle.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, congratulations on your story. That's fantastic. As I was introduced to Nancy Mathis, I now run the Wallace McCain Institute for Business Leadership at the University of New Brunswick, and over the last 15 years, I've come full circle. I started at the university. I was a master's student, PhD student, commercialized my PhD research, went into business, created the Receptor Company with my husband for a sensor technology that ended up being used by Intel, IBM, Lucent, Procter & Gamble, GE, ExxonMobil, 18 of the top 20 pharma companies in the world. And at the time that the intellectual property sold 4 years ago, this company had really dabbled, I would say, in 50 countries. At that point, I ended up going back within a university environment because as a PhD in chemical engineering, what do I long to do besides being an entrepreneur? I long to scale. And doing it once myself was one thing. helping others through the process is where I'm at right now. So to give you some bits on this question that we're asking around innovation, commercialization, and international trade. As I looked at that title, so another tidbit, I won the Manny Award, the Principal Manny Award for the technology in 2003, which is the top award for innovation in Canada. So this innovation was, you know, substantial in terms of peer recognition. But as I think about innovation, commercialization, and international trade, I think my big mistake as we went through the company was we did that too close together in time frame. I think we were commercializing the innovation and trading internationally all at once. And I think that's even scarier now for entrepreneurs because with the availability of international marketing, you translate your brochure, you put it on your website, you buy a Google AdWord, and boom, you're exporting to China. And that's sometimes a success, but not until you actually get into what that truly means. When you don't have a distributor on the ground, when you don't have market knowledge, all of a sudden, you've got multiple translations of your brochure for a product that really maybe is alpha. If you were really going to face yourself in the mirror and say, how much robustness does this product have? As an entrepreneur the first time through it, you never really have an idea of what your product is until you look in the rearview mirror. I probably went for 8 years really ticked off with people who would say, oh, well, that's not a product yet. That's not a product yet. My venture capitalist, that's not a product yet. 10 years later, when it was a product, I could see it in the rearview mirror and say, yeah, now I have a product and I understand what you've been telling me for the past period of time. A product is not a brochure. I think entrepreneurs think the minute they can put a brochure about it, put it on the website, they have some specs. The entrepreneur, if they're technology-based, they can write a phenomenal white paper. They can do a conference talk. They could do a poster. They might have some initial trial customers, and boy, that's a product. Eventually, I realized that a product exists when you've got maintenance terms, you've got a service agreement, you've got a deployment rollout map that you can describe to a multinational company about how they're going to take this new technology and step it through their 16 plants in a manufacturing space. You've got a training protocol for new employees that are taking on your technology, new users, instead of the user is in the lab and they can, you know, they have a PhD and that's what they require to use the technology. That's simplification and robustness. The product packaging is finalized. It's not something that's living at a lab desk, and if you shipped it, good heavens, you've got it packed so that FedEx can't even hurt it. That transition from alpha, beta to final product, I never knew it going through it. And only a few brave people told me. And it was really hard to listen when they told me. And it has to happen in a trusting environment. And that takes me to where I am today. The Wallace McCain Institute is founded on a variety of different programs. Howard stood up earlier and asked us all to be more optimistic, I think, in our conversation. But thanks to Howard, Ian Klugman at Communitech, some folks here at Oakery, and my information about Young President's Organization, I took those four models, combined them, again, sprinkled some chemical engineering design need onto it, and came up with a model for peer groups in New Brunswick which fit the geography. What we do at the Wallace McCain Institute is the flagship program takes entrepreneurs that are exactly at the stage that Isabel's at. They have 50 to 100, we've had up to 1,000 employee companies. I don't focus on students. And remember the part where I'm at the University of New Brunswick. I don't have any students. I take mid-career entrepreneurs who've been growing like this, and then all of a sudden their Chamber of Commerce gives them an award and says amazing things about them from the podium, and they've got to get up, they're in the paper, everybody's talking about them, and what happens is they get, some of them tend to turtle. The light's on me, I see my own shadow, and now I'm scared. What are they saying? That's not me. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm one of the 80% of entrepreneurs that's never, ever taken a business course. And here they're telling me I'm the answer to the province's economic woes. They get scared, and their growth trajectory starts to flatten off. And that's where our group interjects. We've talked this morning about the value of smart money. Totally agree, whether it's angel or venture capital. We've talked about the value of mentorship. What this is peer mentorship. So in a group of 15 entrepreneurs that come together for a year, they go off in a retreat 2 days a month for a year, and they talk challenges to one another. It's open, it's frank, it's confidential. So when someone says, I'm going to China for a trade show, someone will say, why are you going to China for a trade show? Your product's not ready. And they'll give you the real skinny. Sometimes it's very hard for the entrepreneurs to hear it, but it's truthful and it's honest. And everybody in the room knows that the only reason someone's saying that is because they truly do care about that entrepreneur and their success. So I take you through the walk from, you know, it's too easy to internationally trade at the same time that you're commercializing your innovation. That can't happen all at once. Separate them. And you had a wonderful situation where you could go deep in your home territory before you branched out. I was thrust globally instantly. First sale in France to the University of Lille, second sale to Whirlpool in Brazil, third sale to Case Western University, and by my fourth sale, we were talking about needing to translate our software into German so that we could sell it into Germany. So I was dealing with all of these things, and the software probably was still riddled with bugs. Why would we spend our limited resources on translating it into German in order to hit that market? But we had to go very wide because of the kind of product it was. So the things to think about, take it slowly if you can. Separate the commercialization of the innovation from the international trade. Don't go too fast, too hard, too soon. And surround yourselves by people who will tell you the real story. That can be consultants. And in the model that we use, it's fellow entrepreneurs that will look you in the eye and say, that's whacked. Tell me why you're doing that. And really mean it and really love you for trying anyway.
Okay.
You ready to pass?
All right.
Thank you.
On to Todd, who will talk about EDC's
research. As an economist, I'm probably not going to be as upbeat as the previous speakers, but I'll try.
We're supposed to kick him if he goes too low.
I promise I won't speak about the economy. Basically, both Jean-Francois and I are with Export Development Canada, and some of you probably know who we are, but for those who don't, we're Canada's export credit agency. We're I guess the equivalent to USXM in the United States. And we have a very, very broad mandate, which was given to us some decades ago through an act of parliament. And basically our mandate it's twofold. This isn't the exact wording, but the first is to enhance Canadian trade capacity. And the second is to support Canadian companies in their pursuit of international business opportunities. What that basically means is we can do pretty much anything we want, unlike other ECAs, which don't have such a broad mandate. To get things going from our end, I'd like to spend just a couple minutes discussing our view of what we see as international trade. A lot of people think, well, you're exporting, you're in the international marketplace. In terms of how we structure our financial product offerings, whether it be financing, insurance, bonding, those kinds of things, we have expanded that model into what we call the integrative trade model, and it looks at the complete package of what constitutes trade. There's the traditional sort of exporting of goods and services is still a big component of that. There's also coming into that is the importing of goods and services, the importing of inputs and intermediate components is a big part of that package these days. Then there's the Canadian direct investment abroad, which companies use to establish a presence in foreign markets, setting up affiliates and subsidiaries, whether it's a small sales office or a big factory, the whole range there. And then, of course, there's FDI into Canada, another important element. So what we've been, and underneath all this structure of integrative trade, you do have a very broad a supporting framework of the logistics, the financial intermediation, the marketing, the research and development, design of new products that support that broader package. And a lot of our research on my team, we're the corporate research department within NEDC, and sort of our mandate within EDC is to analyze all these international trends and goings on and whatnot, and with the focus of sort of enhancing EDC's offering to Canadian companies. So a lot of our research and analysis does revolve around this integrative trade model. So we've been looking at the role of CDIA, and particularly the role of CDIA. CDIA is Canadian Direct Investment Abroad, so it's Canadian companies making investments in foreign markets. FDI is foreign direct investment into Canada, so it's the opposite, foreign companies investing in Canada. So our research around CDIA is focused primarily on how it can help SMEs take advantage of market opportunities, growth. We've done a lot of research on FDIN. We're looking at R&D financing, and I'll let Jean-Francois talk a little bit more about some of these specific offerings. We've done work on venture capital and equity, and in fact, for those of you who don't know, EDC does have an equity department that invests in VC funds, but mostly in other countries. Some in Canada, but we've invested in VC funds in India, Brazil, Europe, Eastern Europe, China, and around the world. Trying to increase the presence in foreign markets. So a whole range of different research activities that go around focus on this integrative trade model. And overall, our research does indicate that companies who adopt or engage in this type of integrative, more comprehensive approach to trade are more successful. You typically see higher growth. They're more profitable. They have higher growth in sales, more productive. And, of course, that's where the more productive productivity comes in, very critical in terms of boosting Canadian firms' competitiveness. As most people probably know, our productivity performance has been rather dismal in recent years, if you compare it to the U.S. So we do recognize that there are many, many benefits, wealth creation, if you will, that such a structure can generate for Canada and for Canadian companies. And because of that, EDC will support all aspects of this integrative trade framework. And in recent years, we've started financing Canadian direct investment abroad. Just this year, we now have a new program in place to support FDI into Canada. And of course, we can do foreign affiliates support. So, for example, you have a Canadian company with an operation in Taiwan, and they're shipping goods and services to Japan. We can underwrite that, provide financing, insurance. So wherever Canadian companies are operating, we can help them. And of course, that all evolved because we do recognize that. So the production and delivery of goods and services has gone global, and we do really do believe at EDC that Canadian companies do need to adopt a global strategy to tap into this globalization phenomenon. And, of course, to do that, it's you get into the fact, well, particularly for smaller companies, when you start going global, you have to become more innovative. You have to become innovative to have the products and the competitiveness and the capability to compete in those markets. But it's not just a one-shot deal. You don't say, oh, I'm innovative, now I can go international. Once you do go international, you're exposed even more to competition, and all the companies all over the world are trying to get the same, more of the pie as well. So this process of innovation is just continuous, ongoing. I'm sure you guys could certainly expand on that. It's not just a one-shot deal. You have to maintain that momentum as you go forward. And of course, to do this kind of internationalization, I won't get into too many of the details there. Jean-Francois will talk a bit about that. But you do need the management skills, the human resources, marketing. You need to understand foreign markets, the logistics, legal, regulatory framework, different standards. And of course, the most important, perhaps, is probably access to financing and insurance services. And this all sounds great, and it's something that large companies and the middle market do all the time, and they can certainly take advantage of this kind of framework to grow their business. But it's really, really challenging for small to go out and tell a small company, well, you need to globalize. We have seen many. I could sit here and list off several dozen companies that have successfully done that, sort of in the range of $10, $15, $20, $25 million a year in annual sales. But for smaller companies, it is very challenging. The lack of resources and knowledge and expertise to do that is, for many of them, is just not there. But again, you know, having that type of global footprint really does improve their chances of becoming a successful company. And it is a difficult process to undertake when you don't have the resources. But having that kind of global view and approach does provide companies with a better understanding of the market's needs. And it helps them to, having a presence in a foreign market, you're sort of close to the ground kind of thing, helps them to fine-tune their products, fine-tune their services, maybe adapt it to meet the local standards, cultural standards, regulatory standards, and whatnot. And I think this sort of goes back to the one of the things that came out of the Waterloo Declaration was that sort of recognize the importance of the of customer need. And if you don't understand that customer need, then you can't add value for them, and you can't get the revenue sales to go along with it. So it's our view that when companies start to go on this global process, that's a way of sort of understanding the customer's needs. So I'll stop there, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, and he's going to speak a little bit more on sort of the obstacles and challenges and what EDC has on offer to help that and some of the new areas we're exploring into helping that process.
Thanks, Todd. So what I'll be discussing briefly is, you know, what is EDC's role in helping startups and SMEs internationalize and remove some of the impediments to internationalization, and we certainly look forward to some of the comments and questions that you might have and towards our present role. And for the participants from other countries, it might be interesting as well to contrast that with the operations of the export credit agencies in your countries. We know financing is obviously something that is critical, along with having customers and finding customers and trying to get financing from your customers as much as possible. But EDC, in terms of our involvement with small business, I think it's important to mention that 80% of our 9,000 clients are small business that we define as companies with annual sales of less than $25 million, so small and medium-sized enterprises. So we deal basically with 7,000 small and medium-sized enterprises. That's our customer base. And on the financing side, our suite of products keeps evolving and becoming more and more in tune with the needs of our clients, particularly with respect to pre-shipment financing. So there is a lot we can do, whether it's financing, working capital, inventory, accounts receivable, with or without the presence of one or multiple export contracts. So the flexibility is there. We obviously will be financing capital expenditures, including not just tangible goods, but also that can include commercialization expenses. Canadian direct investment abroad or foreign direct investment, which is as Todd mentioned, an area where surprisingly we are seeing more and more SMEs have a foreign presence. Most often it will not be manufacturing, but it will be sales and distribution or maybe even a warehousing facility. But we can provide financing for foreign direct investment and even foreign domiciled inventory. And the way we provide that financing to small business is never on a bilateral basis. That is, the client must come to us with a banker. And in terms of what is the criteria to be eligible to come to us, well, that's the first fundamental one. So in terms of some of the issues of that early stage or companies that are in the early stages of development, maybe past the VC stage, that's where we come into play, in that the banks play the filtering role, if you want, for us. Companies that are eligible for our financing need to be able to convince a banker that to have some skin in the game as well, because the way we provide support is that clients come to us, they will, with their banker, and the banker will come to us asking us to guarantee the loans that they make to their clients. So that is where we draw the line in terms of the risk-taking. Todd mentioned insurance. Well, we provide credit insurance, which helps with working capital. And we also provide bonding support, and to be more specific, is we'll issue a guarantee to a bank that issues a performance bond on behalf of clients, so that frees up working capital. So those are some of the areas where we're active on the financing side. But clients have been telling us for years, and we're continuously trying to respond, that we'd like you to do more than provide us with financial services and provide us with more of the intelligence that you possess. You're a large organization. You're active in over 180 countries. Can you share some of that information? And we're responding to that right now by better organizing the means by which all of the intelligence within EDC is made available to our clients. We possess a lot of intelligence, country intelligence, sector intelligence, and so we're trying to do that. Small clients in particular are looking for advice on a variety of issues. The strength of the Canadian dollar is particularly survey after surveys that have been coming out recently are indicating that the strength of the dollar is a major issue, preventing companies from either starting to export or to grow their export sales. And the information that is available to small companies on foreign exchange risk management or how to adapt a strong Canadian dollar isn't all that prevalent. And actually research for the academic, looking at it from the academic perspective, the use of derivatives such as hedging instruments for foreign exchange, there hasn't a whole lot that's been a lot of research on the behavior of Canadian companies with respect to that. The only one which I found a detailed study dated from 1996 and came from the University of Waterloo, a study on the usage of derivatives by Canadian companies of all sizes. So it is an issue, and we have recently published a couple of white papers and organized webinars and other means of communicating information, because it is an issue for small companies. They don't know how to go about either adapting to the strength of the dollar or managing the risk associated with the volatile exchange rate. I think I'll stop it here, but it was just to give you a sense of some of the things that we're doing. Some of the areas that we're exploring, though, is in particular we're looking at, as some of you may know, based on our mandate, we are there to support the international activities of Canadian companies. We are not there to provide, for example, financing support for purely Canadian activities. But we know now, as Todd mentioned, with the integrative trade model, we know that the way trade is being organized more and more now, competition is taking place more on a supply chain basis than on a company basis in many cases. So for Canadian companies to be competitive, their supply chain needs to be competitive. And how can we better support the Canadian segments of these global supply chains is one area we're looking at right now. And we're hoping to, as a result of the recession, the Government of Canada gave us for a two-year period, which will end next March, temporary powers to allow us to provide financing for what would traditionally fall under domestic financing. So, for example, if a Canadian supplier is not exporting but selling its goods to an exporter, there are all sorts. We can sometimes do that, but usually it can be difficult for us to support that company, which is not an exporter, but is one or two or maybe three steps removed from the exporter. We would like to do that on a permanent basis, and we are in discussion with the Government of Canada, our shareholder, in order to be able to do that. What that will mean for indirect exporters is that better availability of capital. But what that will mean for exporters as well is that will help strengthen the supply chain so that when they do get pressure in terms of their own international buyers, which will often push them to lengthen repayment terms, they don't have to push that down the supply chain and have that negative trickle effect. So I'll stop it here for now.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. I'd like to just begin the second round, and we'll do this very quickly because we said we'd like to open this up for discussion. And this is obviously extremely complex, multi-layered. We have many agencies in Canada. We have at least three federal agencies. We've talked tax. We've talked procurement. But we want to be a response
focused in terms of trying to look at ways that intermediaries and public policy can affect wealth creation through internationalization. So I will direct my question to actually our two entrepreneurs. What are your priorities? If you were to share from your experiences how intermediaries or government policy might support your efforts to create wealth, what would you suggest?
You're living it right now.
Yes. Well, as I said, one of the focus, even when we didn't have that much customers, was to try to get financing for the marketing effort that we're doing. So when we get customers, to be able to get that support right there, PL financing, for instance. What you talked about, the pyramid, sort of, you know, not being a direct exporter and so on, that's very interesting. And actually, I had, I think, discussion with the VC about that, because it's sort of a different way to do it. You're not directly, let's say, in Brazil, but you are selling through a partner who is selling. And at the end of the day, what you want to create is wealth. So whatever way you do it. So I think that is really interesting, to find ways to support us entrepreneurs where we need the help. And the help is while trying to sell everywhere, you know, you can help there. We talked about that so much, marketing efforts. There's not much. There are some programs there to support just the simple marketing, but that is important. The other thing is, I know that a lot of programs are offered out there, but oftentimes it's so difficult to find them for some reason. Maybe because we don't have the time. Maybe, I don't know why, but talking to fellow entrepreneurs as well, it's pretty general. What are the programs? Are they really available? Sometimes it leaves us with the feeling that the program is there, so we say that we're giving money, but it's so tough either to hear about it, to know where it is, or to get the money that, I mean, what good does it do? So we really need to find a way to, I don't know, centralize information, broadcast information, so that we know what is available. You know, these programs where that's interesting as well. You're selling, so you want to show what you've done. We call that vitrine technology. So it's like vitrine is like a showcase. So showcase, and I spoke, you know, there's a program like that that exists, actually, to be able to showcase and get financing for that. But I talked to the person. He basically told me on the phone, you know what, it's not worth it for you to try, because the effort versus the amount you're going to get, not worth it. And I'm like, okay, that's a guy in charge of the program. So, and I know that other entrepreneurs have took advantage of this program, and they got some good money, but my personal experience was, really? I mean, okay, so, and we don't have time. So he said that to me, and I'm like, he's in a good position to know, so let's move to the next one. That's important, you know? That would be my comment. Thank you.
I think the only thing I'd add to that is any time that you can put entrepreneurs together with one another, I think there's so much win-win. They'll tell you, this is where I got money, and they'll tell you who to talk to and how to get it really quickly. The challenge is convincing entrepreneurs that they can learn from one another and that they should get away from their desk and get away from selling and get away in an environment that they can actually think, because entrepreneurs are going 200 miles an hour and they don't stop until all of a sudden they're looking for a program and they realize this is frustrating because I can't do it in 2.5 minutes. It's that immediate need for gratification. And if you can surround yourself by people that you can quickly pick up the phone and ask, then I think you've got better resources. So any programs that support that is where I'd be. Barbara?
Just one quick comment. Entrepreneurs will deal with banks, and you know there are a number of resources that they deal with on a daily basis. So maybe have the information come through that channel where they are not having us to try to look for, we don't know where it is, we don't know who is providing the information. So just come to us, you know. And they are, like in Montreal, we have Techno Montreal, which is more like a cluster, IT cluster. So information are coming through that, and there are broadcasting information to, I mean, the whole IT sector here. So find these ways of telling us what is there and get the feedback, because we all have similar and different needs, so you'll get a good idea of what it's like.
And Todd and Jean-Francois, maybe something that you would like to see changed outside of EDC or...
I,
outside of EDC, I think one thing that you touched on is that the plethora of information that's available and resources for exporting companies, but for small companies in general. I mean, when we speak to small companies, they're just overwhelmed with the amount of information that's out there, and they're just exasperated, and they give up because they don't know where to start, where to go to. We're probably guilty of that to some extent as well. I mean, we have a lot of programs, a lot of services in place, and we can certainly make that more readily available to exporters. And actually, Jean-Francois is part of a working group, virtual team at EDC. It's a new thing. As we mentioned earlier, we provide a lot of sort of the hard financial products, you know, the financing, the performance bonds, the insurance, and all that, you know, it's necessary stuff. But what a lot of companies need, particularly smaller companies, is they just need information and advice. And, you know, I have this good, I need to export it to Poland. I think I've got some customers over there, but I don't have a clue how to do that, that kind of thing, right? And so we're putting together this advisory services thing. There's a whole range of different things that we're putting into this. It's how to manage swings in the exchange rate, those kinds of things. And we do have some new products coming down the pipeline in terms of development. We are, our team, our corporate research department, we're putting together a prototype of, for lack of a better term, we're calling it an R&D financing program for basically small to mid-market companies. But the focus here, and I'm glad to hear that from the conversations this morning, but the focus here is not the kind of lab research, but it's giving companies that might need $200,000 to tweak their product to sell it to a foreign market, or they might need, it's the marketing efforts, getting the products to commercialize, that kind of thing. So that's, we're hoping will be the focus of that, and we're still in the prototype stage of that. So hopefully that's something, and we will be talking to Canadian companies to see if that's something that they can use. So hopefully that's something that would be of use.
Well, there may be a response from the floor on that as well. I think what I'd like to do, given the time, is open it up and take questions and comments and solutions or perspectives. Okay, we'll start with.
I just wondered whether, do you work with IRAP, where they have technology officers all over the country in the field who are dealing with SMEs all the time and make sure that they can direct their clients quickly to you? Yeah. I think one of the big things that I was hearing, and I've been through it myself, is this business of when you're in a startup enterprise, time is absolutely critical. A week can kill you. It's just too much. And I was thinking that when we started up as a company, the Ontario Development Corporation did something, and I don't know if they were doing it for a lot of companies at that stage or not, but what they did with us was they said, give us a list of your customers, and we'll evaluate the creditworthiness of your customers. And any of those customers that we rank creditworthy, you just have to provide us with a copy of the purchase order, and we'll put the money in your bank, and when they pay us. The big thing about that's money that's coming at the price of your product. It's not coming at the cost of your product. That was huge help to us, and it was very quick. The thing that was good about it was we could put in the purchase order, and the money would be in the bank within 24 or 48 hours. It was that quick. But within 3 years, the bureaucracy got so bogged down in all of this that we were getting paid by our customers before the Ontario government could get it into the bank. But I just wanted to say that timeliness and that kind of way of reducing their risk was just incredibly good for us. And I suspect from what I'm hearing, it would be good for the enterprises that you've got at the table beside you.
Thanks, Douglas.
Next question?
Maybe just a comment on the turnaround time. About 2 years ago, EDC implemented as a trial prototype on one of our financing teams principles of lean manufacturing. The results were immense, very, very positive, and that has now been rolled out to all of the areas of transaction and business development. So that should resonate well with clients who, of course, as you mentioned, time is critical. And the turnaround time on typical financing deals has gone down in some cases by 60%. So that we are more operating more on the same basis as our trying to operate more on the same basis as our clients.
Okay. Next question.
Yeah. Okay. My name is Jukka Alamotka from Finland. So at least all Canadian know Finland at least because we are now relay on your management skills, especially when we are talking about Nokia. But a question that bother me because we have talking about a lot of about location-based issues. We are talking about Center of Excellence, Cambridge, MIT, and so on national interest. But if we're looking at actually the other paradigm that is raising, we are talking about crowdsourcing and that kind of stuff, social media, that is not location-based. If we're looking at Finland, we don't have McGill, we don't have MIT, we don't have Cambridge. So we don't have anything to build on Center for Excellence. What we can do? We have only 5 million inhabitants, so we are only 15% out of Canada. So we need to create something other. So our mission is more, I think so, when I'm looking, because I'm an entrepreneur right now, so my vision is that I will employ 100 Chinese, 10 in Western countries, and one in Finland. So I'm very happy to hire 10 Canadians related to one Finn, if I get financing. So how about not financing Canadian Finns? So how about financing Finnish firms? Then we can hire the Canadians. Because that's the name of the game. So because I'm never going to hire 100 Finns if I'm not hire 1,000 Chinese and 100 in other Western countries. So that's the rule of the game. And I just looking from entrepreneur point of view, not the national interest. But I'm very happy that Finnish government have realized that we need international cooperation first. And that will come also employment to Finland. But we need to hire 100 outside Finland. And, of course, right now there's 100,000 people in Nokia, but only 20,000 in Finland. So
is there a scheme right now? You can give us a quick overview if there's a financing vehicle that supports that.
No? Yeah, that is what I like to hear about you. How about this new paradigm based on the virtual cooperation and especially the cooperation between small businesses that you have already people all over the world. For example, we take an example that 1,000 people investing 1,000 euro to companies or 1 million, and those 1,000 people supporting that small business all over the world. So you have networks all over the world immediately, and we have right now the tools. So this is the new paradigm. So how about this question?
Well, if I understand the question or the point being that Finland as a small country is supporting employment in many parts of the world, and there's a bit of a paradox there. I mean, I think from the perspective of EDC and the way again we perceive, and I think we are attuned to the realities of global trade, the fact that a decade ago it would have been very difficult for us to publicly, just a decade ago, not too long ago, publicly support and announce that we were supporting companies that invested outside of Canada because of the stigma attached to that. Oh, that's the, you know, delocalizing job that's creating, you know, or why are taxed Canadian taxpayers, you know, indirectly funding EDC, which is not true, by the way. We're financially self-sustaining. But why is this arm of government helping Canadian companies establish facilities outside of the country? We're way past that. And that's a big part of what we do, or even for companies of all sizes, and the fact that we're now helping foreign companies invest in Canada is also probably not sure how much it's in the public domain, but that's fairly recent. But that might shock some taxpayers, and yet we're doing it because that's the reality of how business is conducted here. It's good for Canada's productivity. But you could take a simplistic view of that and say, well, why are Canadian taxpayers helping fund the acquisition of a Canadian company? There's certain criteria attached to that, but we do that. We help finance imports. So all of that is at the end of the day, helping, quote-unquote helping, but does benefit job creation in other parts of the world. So Is that the point? Hopefully I'm answering your question.
I think I can add to that. We have a couple of products that sort of go in that direction. We have what we call the pool strategy. So we'll lend you know, a big chunk of money to an Ericsson, a Nokia, Siemens, or it could be a huge line of credit with a Mexican bank. So we give those guys the financing, and there are no direct exports tied to that, but there is an MOU, a memorandum of understanding that these companies or the Mexican bank, as an example, will use their best efforts to supply or procure goods and services from Canada. So, I mean, in effect, we are, you know, lending to a foreign entity, and most of our financing actually does go to a foreign company. How it works, you have a company in Brazil wants to buy goods from Canada, we lend that money to the Brazilian company, they give it to then they buy the goods from the Canadian company, and then the Brazilian company pays us back. A lot of our financing does go to foreign entities in that sense. I don't think we're quite there in terms of direct support for a foreign company, but
or a virtual operation. Okay. Yes. Just bring that back.
Thank you. I'm with the Ontario Centres of Excellence in Toronto. It's a question about bridging some of the capacity that you have mentioned a moment ago. And what we do. We have in the last 18 months built a portfolio of about 110 emerging companies from universities in Ontario. They are not export ready, nor will they be next year. We are working with them and our partners at Communitech and Oakry and Mars to make them export ready in 3 years, 4 years from now. What we see after surveying our clients in terms of how we can help them grow, what is played back to us is make them export ready. So the question for the EDC representatives, do you have in your toolkit anything that can bridge your efforts and what we do? Because in our diagnostic, this is a gap in the commercialization continuum that we try to catalyze.
So So just to make sure I understand, so once you have getting companies export ready, you have them export ready, if I understand, but then it's getting the next step, actually getting them selling their goods and services outside of Canada, if I understand you. Yeah, it says, I was just whispering in my ear, the short answer is no. In terms of all of our financial services, the insurance, the financing, the loans, whatever, it's basically we're underwriting or insuring a sale or an investment. So these companies already have sales, and we don't provide grants or subsidies in that way. But as we mentioned earlier, one area we're moving towards, because we understand that helping Canadian companies trade these days is more than just about giving them money and underwriting their business. It's also about giving them information and how to export. So what we mentioned earlier, I know it's not a complete solution, but I think it is a step in the right direction by offering sort of these advisory services to companies, but in terms of bridging that gap from those startups to the prototype stuff, we have nothing in place to really effectively address that. No.
I think we'll have one more comment, and then we'll
just a quick comment to your question that was not directed to me, obviously, but that bridge, you know, when you are about to be ready eventually to export, I think what's very important is to. I mean, we all will do a lot of mistakes, but we don't have to do them all. So why not link them to other entrepreneurs, to people who have done it or might be a step ahead of them so that they can organize and follow the right steps to get ready for what's ahead, but to understand what's ahead. You know, when you don't know really where you're going or what is required to go there, it's hard to plan for it. It's hard to get ready for it. So this idea and what you're saying, entrepreneurs together, mentoring, coaching, so important. You will do mistakes, but not as many, and you will be able to get to the market faster.
Mm-hmm. I have one. There's a program in Atlantic Canada called Entrepreneurs Forum, and it's funded through IRAP. And IRAP's ANACOA, Atlantic Canadian Opportunities Agency, there's money for dinners for entrepreneurs that are at a critical stage of growth. It can be export, it could be franchising, it could be anything, but they can articulate their growth challenge in about 2 pages. And there's money for a $500 dinner, in which we put a table of 4 to 6 business advisors around that entrepreneur. They present for 20 minutes, and then they get attacked for 3 hours. It's like a PhD defense. It's awesome. Like, there's blood. It's wonderful. And so the entrepreneur has to be very ready. And the beauty of that dinner environment is if you go to 6 different mentors, you're going to get 6 different answers. Then the entrepreneur has invested a whole lot of very precious time, as Doug said, with no firm result. And these entrepreneur forum dinners, at least then those 6 advisors argue amongst themselves, and the entrepreneur walks away with one direction in a 3-hour at zero cost. So the price is right.
We have a similar structure where, and it started, I believe, 3 years ago, where it's public money and private money. We had people from MIT Entrepreneurship Center coming here to train about 10 CEOs with promising companies to go international. And we are now into the 4th years. And the one who got the training, and I was in the first group of people to get it, we are now coaching others, plus what we call a groupe de relève, which are younger entrepreneurs that have less than $1 million in revenues, and helping them getting ready for the next step. So that's how you can, you know, create more wealth. We are helping one another, plus getting the help from the ones who've done it.
Okay. Thank you.
Do they do the companies that come for the help, are they like Mario's companies where they don't even have a product yet, or should they have some traction?
One is called it's a growth program basically, and you need to have revenues, and I believe it's 2 million plus. But the other one that they just launched this year, they're accepting more CEOs, about 20 as opposed to 10, and they are really early on. Like if they have $100,000, they're okay to follow the program, but the cost is not the same. You know, it's a lot less expensive. What you get is one training with an MIT coach, and then 10 hours with coaches like myself. So we've done it, we've some different experience, and you have access to all these people. So it's two different. The idea is, let's cover as much as we can, as much ground as we can, and let's pass on the word, you know. So more revenue, but some revenue. I mean, it's not just an idea. You need to be involved, you know, to have some skin in the game as well.
And, Jeffrey, with Entrepreneurs Forum, it can be zero revenue. It can be a business plan. It can be a concept. You just have to be IRAP fundable. Like, you have to meet IRAP's definition of their use of funds in order to qualify for Entrepreneurs Forum.
Okay, I think some good ideas presented by our panel, and really focusing on information, triage, and assembling and digesting and trying to streamline the availability of programs, as well as peer-to-peer mentoring seems to be some of the themes that came off today's panel. I'd like to, on behalf of all of us, thank you for all of your insights, and I think we are ready to break. So merci beaucoup. Thank you.
Good luck.
Very much.